call the Committee on International Trade and Tourism back. We've been in recess since the last meeting, and we call it back to order. And I'd like to note that Representative Mulder, Speaker Phillips, Representative Eldon, and Representative Ryan, and joining us at the table also is Representative Roper. In the last meeting, we asked a series of questions, and I have some questions. I received these about 2 hours ago, and I know that the committee hasn't had time to really analyze all the answers or look through, but I've looked through them, read them, and I've asked my staff, Marco, and we haven't even conferred with each other, so I'm going to ask some of these questions as we go through, and then ask Marco, so we have it in some sort of order that we're not skipping around, if he has any questions that I have missed. And it, maybe some of the other committee members will also have questions that it pertains to. And the first, Kurt, if you could maybe come up to the table. And maybe, I'd like to check Anchorage. Who's online in Anchorage?
They're sending the list down.
Okay. We have some, but anyway, as soon as Anchorage, if Kurt can't answer the question, I know he can answer them all, but if he needs some help, we'll go to Anchorage. And this, in response to this, to the questions that the committee asked last week, they have tried to group and minimize the duplication in their responses if it had similar questions. Some of them, I think they've grouped well. Some of them, there's probably some more questions still to be asked. So with that, I'm going to start the question off on page one. Or Kirk, go ahead.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I've got a sort of a summary and some prepared comments to make, if I might, and
sure.
Then open
please,
it up to questions,
do.
If that's okay with you. For the record, my name is Kurt Park, and Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And again, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for sponsoring HB 432. And I apologize to you and the committee for not getting these questions to you any sooner than we were able to, but I assure you that a considerable amount of time was spent on trying to pull together answers for, as you can see, a long list of questions before us. I'd like to sort of summarize what some of the key issues were that were brought up and also respond to a couple comments that were made in previous testimony, if I might. With regard to the planning process, there were some questions regarding that, and the planning process that brings this project to you has been thorough and comprehensive. And just to, I think the person who summed it up the best was the Alaska Airlines Chair of the Airport Affairs Committee, Cliff Argue, who, if I might quote, said, having been involved for nearly 30 years in the planning and development of airport terminal facilities, I can tell you that the work to date on the Anchorage project is among the most thorough and professional such effort I have seen. The needs assessment, conceptual solutions, and financial plan were carefully developed by an expert team of airport staff and consultants. There was an excellent coordination with the airlines at every step in the process as we participated in numerous meetings and reviews. My colleagues from a number of other airlines, including Reeve, Linden, Northwest, United, Delta, Reno, America West, Federal Express, and UPS shared this feeling on the quality of the process. The planning team for this project included National Aviation and Airport Master Planning experts. Regarding the airline vote, there was some question about how that vote shook out, and the airlines voted in support of the plan according to the operating agreement with 13 affirmative votes and 12 negative. Of the affirmative votes, there were 7 passenger carriers and 6 cargo carriers, including the 3 abstentions. And of the negative votes, there were 9 cargo carriers and 3 passenger carriers. Airlines representing 89% of the domestic passenger revenue and 84% of the passenger traffic support the project. Era Aviation responded to a question from Speaker Phillips last week by stating that there were multiple stipulated votes based on the institution of passenger facility charges. And in your packet, we have provided you a copy of all the ballots. And in there, you'll find that there were only two stipulated ballots. One was a stipulation by Delta Airlines saying they supported the project because it included federal dollars. And Reeve Aleutian Airways said they didn't support the project, but they would change their mind if we imposed passenger facility charges. And those were the only two stipulated ballots in there. And we have those for your review. Regarding forecasts and the flexibility of the plan is presented to you is based on detailed analysis of aviation forecasts and facility needs. The forecast annual growth rate at Anchorage for the next 10 years is projected to be 4.8% by TAMS Consulting. For that same period, FAA is projecting 4.15%. AIA historical activity for the last 7 years has been 4.65%. And this has not been a straight line growth, but it's comprised of peaks and valleys. And so you're always going to have a little flat spot and a high peak, and as you average it out, you're going to get a line of growth. And we have an attachment, number two, talks about the forecast. Throughout the planning process, the airlines have been the peer review on determining size and priority of the components of the plan. The plan represents the airline's approved solution, not just the administration's plan. Regarding occupancy rates, when the Concourse C replacement of the plan comes online in 2001, 93% of the available airline rentable space is expected to be occupied. This is based on interviews with individual airlines and written requests for terminal space. The project estimate and schedule. The estimated cost of $191 million and $97 was prepared by a professional design and consulting team and peer-reviewed by construction experts. The estimate is based on good historical information on costs to construct airport projects with unique factors for building in Alaska. The raw terminal construction costs are $142 a square foot and $1,997. These costs compare favorably with national costs for constructing airport terminals in similar seismic zones. The implementation plan for this project is prepared to be cost-effective and minimize disruption to the airline and the public. A piecemeal approach will not meet these objectives. Contrary to a recent testimony from a project opponent, there has never been a $33 million solution for this project. We did present a six-year cash flow requirement to the airlines, with the first-year cash flow requirement equaling $33 million. The plan of finance that supports the project provides an opportunity for funding the design phase services with revenue bonds. This provides a cost-effective way to immediately initiate the project without general fund dollars. The project team will manage the overall project budget throughout the design, procurement, and construction phases to meet budget restrictions. And again, Dave Eberle is the person we have on board to be the program manager of this project. The project schedule calls for a phased approach. The project schedule will be phased to coincide with seasonal construction windows and to manage impacts on airport operations. There is no fast-track construction sequencing being proposed. Regarding the six-year CIP and the rates and fees, the plan of finance anticipates that the ongoing six-year CIP requirements will continue to be funded, as well as the terminal redevelopment project. Effects on the rate and charges structure have been given to the airlines as a basis for their vote. AIA landing fees will remain in the low to moderate range, even at their highest level, when compared to other national medium and large hub airports. Mr. Chairman, last week you asked whether landing fees have gone down over the last couple of years, and I have some information on that. In 1992, the landing fee rate was 84 cents per 1,000 pounds certified max gross takeoff weight. That was 84 cents in 92. Today the rate is 46 cents. It's gone down considerably. What that means in real terms, as an example, today a Convair is charged $5.75 every time it lands. A 737 The landing fee is $59.34, and a 747 pays $383. If I might...
Go, and then we'll ask the question.
And we have attachment number 3 in your handout has a comparison of landing fees. AIA is currently in the early stages of preparing a cargo master plan, which will address future cargo requirements consistent with forecasts and business plan decisions. Like the terminal master plan, the cargo master plan will require thorough review by the airlines and careful financial consideration. Large cargo projects requiring funding in the future will need to address cost-benefit analysis as part of the design-making process on whether to proceed or not. Only those projects determined to be financially viable will be recommended for implementation and consideration by the airlines. We've also included, Mr. Chairman, in your packet an 11-page bibliography of project documents to date. And we have available full documents for your review if you should desire. We have also offered them to folks that you have looking into this project as well. And if I could make one correction, on page 6, I believe, there's a, maybe Representative Elton, if I could borrow yours for just a moment, I can find it for you. Under the question of how much debt is against the ARF at this point, the fiscal year 2005, the last sentence of that paragraph should be 2015. So if you want to change that, that's a correction. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we have staff online in Anchorage, and I believe Mr. King is available to answer specific questions that you might have.
Thank you. And I'm going, as soon as the committee gets their questions done, we're going to Anchorage, and Mr. Ron Simpson talk about, since you've been discussing these passenger facility fees, he's going to elaborate on that. So first, Representative Ryan was first, and then Speaker Phillips.
I've seen you're charging here on comparable fees in America, but since this is an international terminal with the Pacific Rim, I'd like to see what the fee for 747 is at Kempo, Narita, Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, and this new, what the projected fees will be in this new airport in Hong Kong. I imagine, unless something's changed dramatically in the last couple of years, we're talking about disparity of quite a few thousands of dollars, and I wonder why we're not competitive with those Pacific Rim airports. $300 and some for 747 is pretty darn cheap.
She's next, and then Representative Rilford.
Thank you, Mr.
Speaker Phelps, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt, this is just a very small question, but to make sure that it's on the record, on your list of airlines, and I appreciate the fact that you gave us the list of the airlines and their votes, are you still counting America West vote? Aren't they out? Haven't they left?
Mr. Chairman, Speaker Phillips, I believe America West has reduced their operations at the international airport, but I believe that they have not completely pulled out.
It was my understanding that they pulled out in January.
They pulled out, but it's my understanding they're going to be coming back, and perhaps Mort Plum can answer that specific question.
Yeah. Mort, are you there?
Kurt, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, the answer that Kurt gave was correct. They still are a member and a signatory to Anchorage International Airport. They are seasonal at the current time, so they did reduce their service, and they are coming back this summer.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Robert?
I'll pass. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You talked about the 1992 landing fees. That was when Mark Air was, running quite a few flights a day. And then Mark Air, when they quit their activity, they were replaced by Reno and Southwest, is that right, sort of? And but Reno and Southwest were kind of seasonal and sometimes only one flight a day, where Mark Air had many, many, many flights a day. I don't know, you probably know more of that. So the question come to me, when the small carriers do come in, and Alaska Airlines picked up a lot of the slack that Mark Air, but these small carriers come in, and just, even though there's more carriers, there's not the amount of landing fees. How do you make adjustments for that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the demand is met by either existing carriers or new carriers that would come in. And I suspect, depending on what the load factor is for any individual carrier, would determine whether or not you've got a full load and a landing, and you're still paying the landing fee even though you don't have a full capacity plane. That adjusts itself over time, but when Mark Air moved out, you either had new people coming in, landing, and taking up the slack that their landing fees would have covered, or you've got existing carriers increasing their frequency and contributing to the landing fees that would have once been paid by Mark Air. I think that more importantly, what the reduction in landing fees illustrates over this period of time is the substantial growth that we've had at the airport with regard to the cargo side of the ledger.
But getting back onto that, Mark Air, when they were here, they were a lot of flights half full, the same way as Alaska. And so maybe Alaska was flying a fuller capacity, larger capacity, but it's my understanding that the fees are generated regardless of the load by the 737, 747 of their gross weight. Am I right in that?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. It's clearly better if they can have a full load because they're still paying the one landing fee.
Yeah, so they pay the same fee.
Yeah.
But so my point, I don't want to dwell on this, but what the question was, when these were two airlines were head to head and say became one airline, forgetting Reno and Southwest, wouldn't the landing fees in effect, there might be a little bit of frequency, but the fact is that the planes on Alaska was larger capacity. They were taking up the slack by being nearly full or fully loaded. Am I right in saying that?
Mr. Chairman, I can only assume. I have no basis for really being able to answer that question.
That's fine. I'd like to go right now to Anchorage and ask for Mr. Simpson. Ron, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, you're loud and clear.
Yes, for the record, my name is Ron Simpson. I'm the manager of the Air Force Division, Federal Aviation Administration, Alaska Region. We're responsible for administration of the Airport Improvement Program, which provides federal funding for airport infrastructure development projects in Alaska. And federal funding has been a question in regards to this bill. I'd like to talk about two federal funding strategies, one of letter of intent and the second passenger facility charges. Either financial strategy, letter of intent, LOIs, or passenger facility charge, PFCs, can be used to pay off bond debt, either by reducing the term of airport revenue bonds or offsetting the bond financing charges. Both LOIs and PFCs will allow the project to be built with the financial reimbursement paid out over time. LOI and PFC revenues are officially used to pay back debt service and financing costs. In the area of LOIs, Anchorage International Airport submitted their letter of intent application to us on Monday, March 2nd. LOIs are basically a long-term plan for future commitment of AIP discretionary funds needed above the anticipated entitlement funding level. The total LOI application amount for Anchorage International Airport is $47.3 million in AIP discretionary funds requested to be paid out over a 10-year time period. We are currently completing our regional review of Anchorage International's LOI application, ensuring that all program requirements are met, such as a cost-benefit analysis and system benefits. We will have the application submitted to our FAA headquarters by Monday. We are endorsing Anchorage International's LOI application and advocating that it be approved, and we're expecting final decisions to be issued in the June or July timeframe. We have to keep in mind, though, and remember that LOIs are requests for discretionary funding, which is very tentative. There's no guarantee. Anchorage International competes nationally with other airports in the same category for these LOI discretionary funds. Securing airport revenue bonds will help gain LOI approval because it shows commitment by the airport to actually do the project. LOI funding is paid out over time at approximately $4 to $6 million per year over a 10-year period. The LOI must be approved in advance of the project. Therefore, our federal funding is primarily on a reimbursement basis. To go on to passenger facility charges, as I stated in my testimony earlier on this bill, Anchorage International could be earning $5 million annually with PFC collection. And that's a fairly conservative estimate. PFC program was enacted in 1990 as part of the Aviation Safety and Capacity Expansion Act. It basically is a $3 per passenger user fee for use of airport facilities charged where passengers in plane or board aircraft, not to exceed $12 on a round-trip ticket or $6 one-way. PFCs are the most viable way to finance large airport infrastructure development projects. They provide a reliable, guaranteed stream of funding for long-term planning. And PFCs are especially suited for terminal buildings and landside improvements, which are very low priority for AIP discretionary dollars. We have been encouraging DOT plus DOT and PF to pursue PFCs. I participated in the LBNA Task Force public hearings on PFCs in November 1996, when hearings were held in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai. I emphasized the benefits of implementing PFCs. At these hearings, we learned about legitimate concerns regarding the impact PFCs would have on rural Alaska, where aviation is the only means of transportation. We heard those concerns, and we have been working with DOTPF and our FAA headquarters office on proposed changes to the regulation to provide exemptions for rural Alaska. We have received the first PFC application from Juneau in January this year, which we have determined is substantially complete. It's been published in the Federal Register and is now out for public comment. We expect to approve Juneau's PFC application in April, with collection to commence in May. This will be the first PFC approval in Alaska. Juneau's PFC application projects collections of $700,000 annually, or $4.2 million over a 6-year period. By comparison, Anchorage International could be collecting $5 million annually in PFC revenue, or $50 million over a 10-year period. And as I said before, that's a conservative estimate. Nationally, 288 airports have approved PFC programs with annual collections of over $1.15 billion. Out of the top 100 airports nationally, only a handful of airports have not implemented PFCs, primarily in Alaska and Hawaii. I've had several questions asked to me about what are Alaskans paying now when they travel down to the lower 48 in the way of PFC? And even though we don't have statistics to really verify the exact cost that Alaskans are paying at Seattle, Minneapolis, Salt Lake, and other facilities that are collecting PFC, if the state of Alaska requested it, we'd be glad to fund a study for DOT and PF to investigate how the PFC program actually impacts Alaska, look at the fare and route structures, and assess all the impacts. One note I'd like to say for clarification is that the current AIP bill expires after fiscal year 98. LOIs are subject to AIP reauthorization. PFCs, however, once implemented, are not subject to AIP reauthorization. PFCs are the most reliable, guaranteed funding stream to provide for large airport infrastructure development projects as these proposed at Anchorage International. That's all I have for input, and I certainly would be glad to address any questions you may have on either letter of intent, LOIs, or passenger facility charges to PFCs.
Thank you, Ron. Speaker Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Simpson, I appreciate the comments that you made on PFCs, but it's my understanding in speaking with the commissioner that PFCs are not going to be an integral part of the financing of this project. So that having been said, I do have a question for you. You've testified on the 24th of February and again today that you are looking conservatively at PFCs could possibly bring in between over $5 million and up to $6 million per year to the airport. However, you have not stated what we would lose, what we would have to give up in passenger entitlement federal funds if PFCs were instituted. So would you please at this time put on the record, if PFCs were instigated or instituted, what funding would we lose from the federal government because we had put that program into place?
Well, PFCs are intended to supplement AIP, but you're right, there would be a minor reduction in the entitlement, only on the passenger entitlement, if a PFC is implemented. I don't have those exact figures in front of me.
Mr. Simpson, my understanding it'd be about $1.3 million a year. That, in my book, that's not a minor amount, especially when the project looks like you have an annual debt service of about $14.5 million. $1.5 million that you'd be giving up because you instituted PFCs is not a minor amount.
As I understand it, when we're looking at the debt service, the entitlement fund that the airport is earning, he would have to speak to how they are being applied to that debt service in the LOI package.
Speaker Phillips, this is Mort Plum. I don't have the figures before me, and we will be glad to get the exact figures, but I think our entitlements last year were somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.7 for passenger and around 3.1 for cargo. It's my understanding that we would probably lose about half of that, so the 1.3 is correct. It was also my understanding that the net gain with the loss of the 1.3 and the PFCs we would collect would be in the neighborhood of $4 to $5 million net gain, but I would have to I would like to get those figures to you after reviewing the exact charts.
If you would, please. Thanks.
Any more questions? Representative Ryan.
I just want to ask, is this gentleman represent the FAA?
Yes.
Okay. it's my understanding, sir, that the FAA has they have had traditionally for years, an airport improvement fund that was basically funded from taxes on general aviation fuel. Is this the FAA monies, is it coming from this particular fund? It was a couple $1 billion last time I looked.
Yes, the AIP fund comes from the Aviation Trust Fund, and that's made up of fees that are paid for fuel and cargo throughout the country.
So, all right, I'll pass for time here.
Any other questions? Speaker Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's on the PFC issue. I noticed that you have written to Senator Stevens regarding an allowance or an exemption for Alaska smaller carriers on the PFCs. Is this, and maybe Mort can answer this, is there precedence for this in any of the other states that have PFCs in place?
I'd like to try to address that. The PFC regulation does provide for some exemptions. The exemptions are for particular classes of carriers. But the way that the regulation reads now, that has to be less than 1% of the traffic at that airport. Now, something that's unique to Alaska is that when we look at our commuter service, it well exceeds that 1% cap for exemption. And that's basically the relief that we've been asking headquarters for, is based on the uniqueness of Alaska, the fact that many communities have relied solely upon aviation for their transportation link, and the fact that the commuter service well exceeds above 1% of the overall service at the airport, such as Anchorage or Fairbanks, that we be provided an exemption for those class of carriers here in Alaska. And that right now we have submitted adequate justification, rationale, and background for that, and it's actually back being worked through the rulemaking process.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions, committee members? Okay, thank you, Ron. I hope you can maybe stick around, and there might be something you want to respond to a little later on. Kurt.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, not on the PFC issue, and I did mention, though, on the PFC issue that we are talking with the FAA about a program that might take into consideration the unique nature of Alaska, and we certainly wouldn't pose any PFC program without the legislative approval.
You can bet your bottom dollar on that one.
So rest assured, the finance plan did not include PFCs, and unless there's something that's publicly acceptable and takes care of the folks who have no real other options than to fly around the state of Alaska, we're not going to be bringing forward a PFC. If I could just make a correction real quickly on a previous statement, I mentioned that the Convair was a $25 fee. That was, the $25 is for, the Convair was $5, the Convair is $25. It's the Dash 6 yeah. or 7 or whatever that,
yes.
The Dash is a $5 fee. So I just want to make that correction if I might.
Representative Roford.
Well, Mr. Chairman, for the record, how come you're not going to be using PFCs as part of the financing plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberg, PFCs, we don't believe are publicly acceptable at this time, and so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Kurt, I have a. We all know about votes and what it takes to get people to do things, 2/3, 3/4. We live with that every day. How did it come about in this airline agreement that it took 2/3 or 3/4 to turn something down rather than to get something? That's a pretty darn unique situation in the annals of any kind of voting situation anywhere, and it kind of looks like the deck was stacked towards keeping out dissidents. How did this come about? Can you give me some background on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, I'd be happy to give you a thumbnail as I understand it, and then if we need to have some people who've been around a lot longer, explain a little bit more. This was the operating agreement that was negotiated between the state and all the airlines who signed the operating agreement. And it was negotiated in good faith, and they all agreed to that this would be the approach to take for turning down projects. And operating agreements are not unique throughout the aviation industry for airports. And so some operating agreements have a different percentage requirement for vetoing a project. Some have a higher one. We have what's unique about the Alaska International Airport system is the fact that both Fairbanks and Anchorage are a part of it. And you can see what would happen if you allowed a higher percentage of a lower percentage of no votes for a project, say, in Fairbanks. I mean, it'd be very difficult to get projects approved when a carrier doesn't even fly there. And so because of the operating agreement, a carrier landing in Anchorage, it doesn't go to Fairbanks, can vote on Fairbanks projects. I don't know to what extent that was a consideration in the original negotiations of that operating agreement, but it's certainly one of the kind of dynamics that we were faced with today.
I offer a little comment. I've noticed in the NFL, the owners have a little different way of getting a new stadium, but this perhaps is a little more democratic. Anyway, I have a question about the city borough of Anchorage, and I've noticed in the exhibition or attachment 5 here, we got quite a bit of funds for part 150 noise reduction. Do you know if the planning department or the assembly has enacted an ordinance for an overlay noise reduction area around the airport in Anchorage? It's kind of an inverted wedding cake. The closer you are to the airport, or farther away you are, the more noise you can have, or less noise there are.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, there is some consideration, I believe, at this time by the assembly and the administration of the city deal with development within those concentric circles as the noise contours. And I don't think the city's taken any action on that. Perhaps the airport can talk about the overlay that you're referring to.
Well, it's a kind of standard thing throughout the country in planning and zoning. I noticed that I know for 10 years Fairbanks has had one that they have. The airport's been trying to sell to the borough. 8-9 years ago, we hadn't implemented it as of yet. Now, what I further question that begs on that, since that isn't in effect, what is going to be the cost of implementation of this part 150 mm-hmm. in the FAA if the borough assembly and the mayor happen to decide, okay, guys, you're getting a lot more traffic up there, it's really getting to be a pain in the neck, and we want to keep residential areas from encroaching on there and having the complaints and stuff, so we're going to stick this on here. What's it going to cost us? Anybody looked at that, has done any conceptual planning and figured out what kind of bucks it's going to, because it's going to come back on the airport.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, yes, that's a problem that every large airport in the country has to deal with when there's a conflict between residential growth and airport growth. And in some cases, the airport will have to pay for some kind of mitigation, whether it's soundproofing of a home or even purchasing the home. Clearly, that's an issue that the Part 150 study is addressing, and we're working with the city on that. And if you want, I think Mort can talk more specifically about those efforts, but it's an ongoing issue that we're addressing.
Well, what I would like to see, if possible, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, is that somewhere in the planning process, in a budget item, that somebody start looking at this and figure what the cost of implementation. I'll give you an example. An old 707 and 720, which a lot of airlines still use for cargo hauling, a hush kit on those things run about 10 years ago, $1.5 million. Gosh knows what they are nowadays. And if you want to get into most of the major metropolitan areas in the world, you have to put that hush kit on. So there's an expense on all sides. And this ordinance is of such a way it keeps people from moving in next to the runway and then complaining about the noise. Mm-hmm. And so the costs are on all sides. I think it would be a reasonable thing to plan because of the eventuality it's coming.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, you're absolutely right. In fact, there are federal FAA requirements for moving towards the quieter aircraft and putting hush kits on. In fact, I believe Velasca has recently announced that they've put all their aircraft into with the hush kits in advance compliance of some requirement that's coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, well, in the summer, I don't know. This summer, I don't remember hearing them, but in previous years, Alaska would start using the old cargos. They'd put the seats back in them and the straight jets, the 100, 200, go out, and they'd ring your ears for a long time. Mark Eric ran them. Okay, thank you. Go on, Mr. Chair.
Are there more questions? I have, if we could go through the answers, before I do that, Leif Selkreger, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Leif, I've had some questions about your background, and rumors get going and everything, and I'd like to hear from you. The concern was your involvement in the Performing Arts Center in Anchorage. Could you elaborate on that for the committee?
Certainly. I'd be more than happy to do that for you. As you know, I am a lifelong Alaskan and began my professional career in Alaska in 1980 as a project manager. Between 1980 and 1988, I worked on a series of major capital projects in the area of the municipality of Anchorage. In 1980 to 83, I was the on-site construction manager for the Sullivan Sports Arena. I was employed by an international project management company. From 1983 to 1985, I was the program manager for the new police headquarters and animal control shelter, again with an international project management firm. In late 1985, early 1986, I was approached by Mayor Knoll's administration to consider coming on board as the on-site construction administrator for the Performing Arts Center. My role began on that project after footings and foundations had been installed and the structural steel general contract placed with Kiewit Construction, who was also the construction manager. I had had no role whatsoever in the 5 years of previous planning, design, and budgeting. But I did lead the on-site construction team, which was responsible for finishing that project. My first responsibility on that project in 1986 was to develop a cost-to-complete analysis. It was a tough message to deliver, but we did deliver it to the administration and the public, and with Kiewit Construction, and I have to say the support of a lot of Alaska contractors, we managed to wrestle that project to completion and successfully in terms of no construction claims. It was a very challenging responsibility, but it was one that I was committing to finish. I worked, therefore, for the Sullivan administration, the Knowles administration, and the Fink administration on major capital projects in Anchorage. Since that time, I have worked internationally. One of my major responsibilities was the program manager for the expansion of Heathrow Airport, New Terminal 5. I was on board there for the first 2 years of that program. That program is continuing in London. That was a $1.5 billion terminal expansion program. Also worked with General Electric Plessey Telecommunications, upgrading airport facilities across the United Kingdom. Since 1994, I have been back here in Alaska, developing a national project management company. I have offices here in Anchorage, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Seattle, and employ about 50 people. Very proud of the fact that we have great project management capability here in Alaska, and we've been doing a good job of exporting those skills across the country. I am responsible for several major projects here in Alaska. You may know of the Alaska Sea Life Center, where I've been responsible for assembling the $60 million in funding and overseeing the planning design, and we are just finishing construction in Seward on that project, which opens to the public May 1st. I'm more than happy to answer any specific questions about any aspect of my professional career.
Were they, I know, can you elaborate a little bit on any cost overruns? I know you said there was no change orders or charges or things like that. And I realized that the Performing Arts Center was put up by in a shell by one contractor, then somebody else. It wasn't a total originally. I don't think the plans were complete. So there's two or three Hoffman and yeah. So can you elaborate on that?
Yes, I can. At the time I was brought on board with Kiewit as the construction manager, we estimated the cost to complete for the project. This was in 1986, and the cost to complete exceeded the funds available to finish the project. I think the funding for the project was about $45 million. And in 1986, when I was brought on board, I developed a cost to complete for the project that showed that that project was going to cost closer to $86 million. With the construction community, we proceeded to value engineer $10 million out of that cost to complete budget. I think the final cost on the project was somewhere between $72 and $73 million. This was still in excess of what the administration at the time had assembled for funding. The administration did make additional dollars available. We did not at any time buckle under the pressure of the complexity of the project in terms of the value engineering exercise. Again, I have to tell you that the Alaska construction community, there were 13 contractors, Alaska contractors, that built that project. Every one of them was involved with cost reduction exercises as part of their bid packages. From the life of the on-site construction manager, that was a very successful project. I think from the public perception, it was a project that had been under budgeted. And when it came time to tell the story about what the project cost was, that story came late. That was my job, by the way. When I came on board, my first responsibility was to tell the administration what the final cost for that project was going to be. We did that. It was a tough story to tell. And we then managed to bring that down by about $10 million through the help of the Alaska construction community.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to just let the committee know that I have all the resumes that we asked for, and I didn't want to make copies and kill another tree to make the copies. Anybody that needs copies, I'll make them available to them. One more question, Lee. Were there any overruns on the Sea Life Center?
No, sir. We are currently finishing that project on budget. It's been a huge project, both in terms of putting together the $60 million through private fundraising, a plan of finance, and support from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. We've had tremendous leadership from representatives from the community on our Board of Governors and Board of Directors. We are opening to the public on May 1st. We are trying to accommodate the schedule of the legislature for that grand opening and doing our best there. It is a big construction project. We haven't had any cost overruns, and we're in the final stages of completion.
Okay, thank you. I didn't. It wasn't my intention to target you or anything, but there were some questions, and I thought it was very important that you have the opportunity the first to answer some of the concerns, and I appreciate your upfront answers. Next, one question of Kurt, and then I'm going to ask Butch Halford to come up. On page one, and it's because I'm not real familiar, it says something that the project is designed to accommodate 3 million employments or 6 million passengers. What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, employments is people getting on the plane. Deplanements is getting them off. So you've got people getting on and off for a total of 6 million. So employments is counting the folks as they board the plane.
They won't let us stay on.
Well, no overnights.
Okay. Well, that's clear. And if at this time, if I could ask Mr. Halford to come up, please. Identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and please feel free to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Butch Halford. I'm the Vice President of Northern Air Cargo based in Anchorage, Alaska. The Anchorage International Airport System has hired some of the most highly regarded experts in their respective fields to evaluate and assess and design a terminal expansion for Anchorage International Airport. They've spent several million dollars producing hundreds of pages of analyses, projections, data, assumptions, concepts, summaries, calculations, etc. The product of all this work is complex and convoluted. It is the nature of the beast that it is. Without attempting to go over the entire mass of paper line by line, suffice it to say that I'm uncomfortable with many of the assumptions and projections that have been made. We agree that the terminal could use some sprucing up. In fact, we think it's a good idea, and we support it. We do not, however, support such a grand plan that does not address adequately the risks that we face if we fail to meet those expectations. If the traffic doesn't come, who pays for it? Those of us who live here, that's who. It is unfathomable to me that to renovate and upgrade the terminal to a reasonable level should cost over $200 million to begin with. That seems that there is either way too much for what we need, or we're paying way too much for what we're getting. Despite the immense cost before us, please keep in mind that it's only the first part of the greater plan. There's at least a second phase that, complete with the new parking garage, will no doubt also cost over $200 million. There are plans for substantial development in both the North Air Park and the West Air Park as well that could also run into hundreds of millions of dollars. The projected landing fees don't appear to consider these other projects, nor that we'll have much in the way of runway repaving or replacing any pieces of snow removal equipment, etc., in the meantime. And they don't appear to take into account much in the way of other capital projects. Except for paying for a significant amount of it, the cargo carriers, both domestic and international, are not really impacted by a terminal renovation and expansion. We derive no direct benefit from it whatsoever. And simply put, the terminal consists of the Anchorage Domestic, Anchorage International, and Fairbanks Domestic Terminals. Under the terms of the operating agreement, the total cost of operating and maintaining, including the debt service, of the three terminals is by dividing the total number of square feet in the terminals by the total cost of maintaining and operating them to determine a cost per square foot. Then each tenant pays that rate for whatever space they lease. The concessionaire, rents, parking, duty-free revenues, etc., are also applied against the terminal M&O costs. Unleased space, which includes common areas and other space not available for lease by an airline or concessionaire, such as the concourse areas, airport management's administrative offices, airport security, the governor's private conference room, etc., is paid for by landing fees. Today, with approximately 90% of the leasable space rented, 31% of the terminal costs are borne by landing fees. That figure is projected to reach 40% when the terminal comes into service in the year 2002. Cargo carriers currently pay approximately 70% of the landing fees, and the models for the new terminal provided by the airport are at least initially for less than 90% occupancy. Coupled with the projected cargo growth higher than that projected for passenger growth, the portion paid by cargo carriers will grow even larger over time. Nevertheless, cargo carriers do not arbitrarily oppose projects that do not directly benefit them. We all have a long history of supporting reasonable and responsible and justifiable projects that benefit the community or airport as a whole, even when there's no direct benefit to the cargo carriers, and the record clearly reflects this. It is prudent to be cautious, though, and ask tough questions and demand clear and satisfactory answers, particularly when paying sums of money of this magnitude. I require less certainty when contemplating spending $20 on something than I do when I contemplate spending $20,000 on something, and a lot less than when I'm spending $200 million on something. $200 million of anything demands scrutiny, and that the need be clear and the cost reasonable. It's said that facts are stubborn, and sometimes very stubborn. For $200 million, we must all be stubborn as well and get every fact, stubborn or not, it is important beyond belief when applied to that much money. And even if the airport's projections are accurate, Do we truly need such an ambitious expansion to accommodate them? And is this the way that you would spend your own money? Who really needs this terminal? Well, the people that live in Bethel don't. The people that live in Ketchikan or Juneau or Kotzebue don't. In short, the people that live in Alaska don't really need it. And the people that visit Alaska don't choose to stay home because the terminal may be crowded when they get there. As for the Alaskans that live in the rural parts of our state, they are already the least able to afford even the slightest cost increase. They clearly don't have the money to waste on things they don't need, and they don't need a $200 million terminal. How much can the two airports afford? Well, if you assume that landing fees and terminal rates can be increased ad infinitum, and that it's okay to pay $12 for a hot dog that you're only getting off with for $4 for now, then I suppose it is limitless. But in reality, there is a limit. If cargo grows anywhere near the levels forecast, then the airport will no doubt require further substantial investment in the next few years to come. How much bonding can the airport secure? And even if they can get the bonding, how high do the landing fees have to get before carriers would rather spend that money on Russian overflight fees or new longer-range aircraft that no longer need anchorage at all? The well is not bottomless. I urge a measured, incremental approach to meeting our terminal expansion needs. We can always build more. Once built, however, we can't tear it down, and the expense doesn't go away if we find out that it was overdone. First, establish clearly defined trigger points to determine when to make additions and expansions. Then closely define what needs to be done and provide a precise cost estimate for it. Only then, with the facts, figures, and justifications before them, before you, can the legislature make an informed decision and confident that the best use will be made of the resources available. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Your concerns, we have contemplated, and I've requested some consultants to help us out on this project. Do you think that would be a prudent thing to do? Our own consultants, the legislature.
More eyes are better. More eyes, objective view of it, may see things that we're overlooking. Like I mentioned, that this is a lot of data and much of it very complex and not easily understood. I'm not an accountant, I'm not a financial manager of any kind, and it is often a struggle for me to understand, you know, these volumes of data. Professionally trained eyes can do nothing but help. I think that's a good idea.
Thank you. And one question then, Representative Ryan. Are there ever cargo-related projects that don't directly benefit passenger airlines? Do passenger airlines complain when that happens that you're aware of?
I can't remember. I cannot remember a case where that occurred. There's, I think, probably fewer projects that are specifically for cargo than there are for the passenger facilities, but I can't remember a case where they said, no, that's for cargo and we won't pay.
Thank you. Representative Ryan.
Well, good old cargo hauler, my kind of guy. I spent 40 years or so doing that, hauling around an airplane, glorified truck driver. I gave a little view to the committee the other evening of how you load an airplane, plan your fuel stops and some things. I won't repeat that. Basically, I used the 747 to 300 series as a model. And we talked about coming up here and planning your fuel so that when you got here, you would refuel for the next leg of your trip. And we talked about the weight of the 350 passengers, FAA weight, and the 70 pounds for baggage, and it left like 130,000 pounds of excess capacity in the aircraft that you could put in the belly and freight to help get the revenue for the plane. And then UPS and FedEx are not, my understanding, breaking down loads now like they would at a hub in Memphis or someplace. It's just kind of a fuel stopover. You got the Russian R-12, it's cargo only, it doesn't seem to be passengers. And then you got this new airport coming out in Hong Kong with 14,000 feet runways. And my question was, where are all these people going to come from for this passenger terminal when it looks to me like freight is what this airport's future is as far as landing at Anchorage, refueling, loading up what freight to fill out your get the gross weight, considering runway and all the good stuff, and go. And I have, you know, and I still with 600,000 people here, and this not being a hub for anybody, I'm wondering where we're getting all these people. Perhaps you can enlighten me on that.
Well, Anchorage for passengers is by and large a destination. It's the end of the road. People pass through places like Seattle. Some get off, and that is their destination, but a good many continue on. Anchorage doesn't really behave that way. I don't think that it's unique, but probably for an airport its size, it's at least unusual. On the other hand, the cargo is, in many ways, mimics that traditional passenger traffic patterns by coming here on the way somewhere else. Some gets off, some more gets on. I do believe that both FedEx and UPS and United do a limited amount of interchange on their freight between aircraft, and I think they expect to do a lot more. The airport's open skies agreement or arrangement that they persuaded the DOT to do was a great thing for that, and I fully expect to reap many rewards. In terms of the future for Anchorage, the passenger growth is going to have to come primarily from tourism, and perhaps a rebirth of international passenger traffic, but also for tourism. They don't transit Anchorage like they once did, and there's a far less amount of the flights that are passengers with bellies full of freight. All passengers are all freight by and large. I'm certain that there's some exceptions to that. But truly the conventional wisdom forecasts that the future of the Anchorage International Airport and Fairbanks lies more in cargo than it does in passengers.
One follow-up, if I may. Given what you just said, would you think it would be prudent to try to add another couple thousand feet of runway so greater payloads could be carried for these passenger or cargo aircraft versus this big terminal, and perhaps some warehousing with the duty-free zone for bonded warehousing and so forth? Would that look at more of where the future of the airport should go in that direction?
A longer runway to allow maximum payloads has been visited, and we have extended runways both in Anchorage and at Fairbanks. And except for specific weather conditions with temperatures and unfavorable winds and trying to be consistent with noise considerations and not wanting to take off fully grossed wide-body freighters over neighborhoods, I think that they're over 95% of the time they are not payload limited. When they are, it's in the summertime when they have temperature considerations and altitude density, a lot of arithmetic that I'm not all that accomplished at. I'm certain that there is occasionally a flight that is payload limited, but in consulting with all of the international wide-body freight aircraft operators, for the most part, in their opinion, the cost and benefit of a runway extension wasn't worth the few times a year where they get impacted by it.
Good. Thank you.
I'm relying on my memory on that.
Good. That's good to know. Thank you. How about the bonded warehouse?
I think it's just a matter of when. Being a duty-free zone presents many opportunities. The geography of Alaska is not changed, and it's gotten better in terms of connecting the North America, Europe, and Asia. And that's already a proven practice in many places. It's just a matter of when it's the right time.
Thank you.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Holford, you indicated your Northern Air Cargo voted no on the poll or the vote on this. I think we understand why from your explanation, but you indicated in your testimony that you were fearful that the scope of the terminal was basically pretty large and grand and concerned about the cost. But it seems to me, in regard to your firm's operations, are you more concerned about the increase in landing fees that may result if there was problems for paying for this? Or do you see a misallocation or a diversion of funds from away from the cargo development, which would affect your business, into the passenger development? Or what are your concerns in these areas, particularly as they affect your operations as a business?
There's actually some of each. One, we're not anxious for additional cost, and we vigorously fight, you know, the inevitable increase of cost for a number of reasons. One, you know, it makes us less competitive, and two, you know, we feel we have an obligation to be able to provide the service to our customers in rural Alaska as affordably as possible. And we fear and don't take lightly any potential cost increase, whether it come from landing fees or the cost of avgas or health insurance or anything else like that. And I guess if it was you wanted to build a big house next door to me and you were going to pay for it, what do I care? But we do get to pay a not insignificant amount of this project. My other concern along those lines, and it's difficult to foresee, and I may be seeing boogeymen that aren't there, but I'm concerned that there may be something in the future that would really make sense and improve things for cargo operations, that because of our, you know, our cost structure with a debt of this size may make it less likely to occur. You know, I can't be any more specific than that. There is a maximum amount of debt and expense the airport can support.
Thank you. Representative Moser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Butch, you brought up the issue of gas, and I'm sorry to digress here, but seeing as you're not a passenger carrier, you can give a more balanced perspective on their operations. In your opinion, what has
they may argue with you on
that. Well, you can at least give an insight to it. In your opinion, what has a greater determination of the price of an airline ticket, the landing fee or the price of gas?
Neither. What your competitor is charging.
And the only reason I ask is that I've gotten several calls lately that while the price of gas has come down, the price of airplane tickets hadn't, and they were kind of beating on my ear. So when you mentioned that, it kind of sparked that thought in my mind.
For our company, our number one, our highest expense is payroll. And second, and not very far behind it, is fuel. So in terms of the amount of money that we spend a year on fuel versus the amount of money we spend a year on landing fees is pales in comparison. A very small change in the price of fuel can amount to a whole lot of dollars for even a company our size. So if those are the only two things in question, I would say that the price of fuel has more impact than the landing fees.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry to digress, Mr. Chairman.
Butch, what calculation did you do on the contingency on this plan, that's been set aside in this project's cost?
I took the, I can't remember the title of it, I got it up over there, but it was the construction cost estimate. Mm-hmm. And the cover sheet of that showed a line-by-line description of each of the projects that would be required to complete this and the associated price. And then on the following pages was a more detailed description of each item, which gave the anticipated construction price, and then estimator's contingency, change order contingency, which were either 10 or 20% depending on which particular project it was. That brought you to the new subtotal cost of that project. Then there were added to that there's other construction costs of 5% and construction admin, I believe, of an additional 10%, which was applied both to the actual cost of construction and to the contingencies. And then that brought you to the price for that project. That brings you back to the cover sheet where it summarized the construction cost estimate, where those were all totaled up. And then they took 10% for design and admin, 2% for permitting. I can't, without it in front of me, it's, but it was, that totaled 14% that was again applied to the other contingency costs. To determine what the part was actually construction, identified as construction, and the part that was expressed as a percentage, I just took those construction figures and subtracted them from the total, and what was left over was the indirect costs. And that was around 53% was the line item for the cost of the project, and just under 47% was for the items that were identified, you know, by a percentage.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Butch. If you stick around, maybe we'll have you back.
Sure.
I'd like to go this time. I know we have some people that's not government connected in Anchorage, and that we certainly welcome them to stick around to the total meeting, but I'd like to go to Anchorage now in case they have other commitments. And they got to go out and make a dollar or something. Mr. DeJarlis?
Yes, my name is Gerald DeJarlis. I'm the president of Summit Paving and Construction here in Anchorage. I live at 2131 Sorbus Way in Anchorage, 99508. It sounds as from what I'm hearing, as if I may be a bit premature on this for my comments, but seeing the magnitude of the of the project, I wanted to add my comments from the perspective of a general contractor. Based on what I've heard of the project, I think support it. I think our airport is a major economic asset to the Anchorage and to the state. My comments concern, as I say, the size of it. The volume of work in Anchorage or in Alaska is such that few of us can justify gearing up in bonding equipment and organization to take on huge projects, and too often the very large ones, the majority of them go to outside contractors. I think we'd all agree that the value of such a project as this is enhanced when a majority of the dollars for construction stay in Alaska. I wanted to urge that, assuming it does go forward, that it be broken into a sufficient number of phases to permit a significant number of Alaskan contractors to bid on the work. Just prior to the hearing starting, I was advised by Mr. Kettner that apparently there is the intent to break it into 15 or 20 phases, and on that basis, I think that my only closing comment would be that I'm looking forward to seeing the bid packages. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. DeJarlis. Is there any other private people in online that would like to testify on this? If there's not, At this time, I Representative Ryan.
Talk to Mr. Plum before you get wrap up, Mr. Chairman.
I'm not wrapping. I'm just getting started. I'd like for the members maybe to go to the handout that was clipped together, and we have about 8 pages of, I think, of or maybe more, 10 pages that of questions that in the last hearing that we did, and I'd just like to go through and ask the committee members if they could go through this, and we're keeping kind of in order, and then we're not skipping around so much. And if anybody would like to start on page 1, if they have any questions in light of the questions that they answered, we could go that.
I can get them started.
If Marco could get them started, and then maybe somebody else could jump in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marco Pignalbury, staff to Representative Cowdery, and when we received this package this afternoon, Representative Cowdery asked me to highlight some issues that might lead to questions to assist the committee, because you had such a limited time to review this before the committee meeting. So I'll just go through a few things that raise questions during our cursory review. First of all, on page number 1, the first question, which has to do with what the plane passenger capacity at Anchorage International Airport will be and how long it will satisfy anticipated demand. At the end of that answer, they say that one of the factors determining terminal expansion is the ability of airlines to share or to cross-use gates. And a question comes to mind is, you know, can they or can't they? Who makes that decision, and why is it an open question at this point? If the projections are made as to the gate sizes and what type of aircraft will be there, then is it a management airport management decision? Why should that be an open question at this point? And then, according to the passenger forecast, an additional 4 jet gates may be needed between the years 2010 and another 4 jet gates in about 2015. What is the cost? And we keep getting back to this question: can the airport revenue fund support additional projects, additional capital expenditures that will be needed while this $190 million debt is still being paid off at the rate of about $14 million a year? So those are the factors that came to light on just that first question.
And I'd ask whoever, Kurt, you would like to answer the question, that part, and then we'll go to the committee members.
Mr. Chairman, I think that in Anchorage, we have Mort Plum, who can speak to the issue of cross-use of gates, but it principally is a matter of interest by the airlines, whether or not they want to share a gate as well as the equipment itself. But Mort?
Mr. Chairman, the folks that did the forecast analysis went to the airlines, and they were offered the opportunity to use a cute system, as it's called, the common use terminal. And the preponderance of those that chatted with the consultants on this did not want to use common use terminal space, because when they do that, they have to switch out computers, etc. So that was one of the fundamentals that went into that, into determining the number of gates. The larger driving area may be the schedule, and that is that in Anchorage, as you know, in the late evening hours, many of the airlines arrive at the same time. So it's not only the ability to use the same gate, but it's also the conflict of having several airlines on the ground at the same time. So all those went into determining the number of gates. Back to the original question, it was the airlines that determined if they wanted to use common use space
minimize some of the gates. And in fact, in our planning, we have allocated three of those to cross-utilize, although currently at Anchorage, we are not cross-utilizing any gates.
Thank you. Representative Ryan, then Representative Roper.
Well, this total employment for 7 years from now of 10 times the population of Alaska is 6 million people is going to take an awful lot of airlines coming in here and dropping off passengers that are going on to future other destinations with other carriers. So we're going to have something like United or American, or not flying a route in competition with KAL or Cathay Pacific or somebody like this, and dumping their passengers here, interlining them off to this other airline. Or everybody in Alaska is going to have to go somewhere 10 times a year. I understand what projected growth is and so forth, but I just have difficulty visualizing this many people out of Anchorage. Can you give me an explanation how we're going, where they're going to come from?
Mort, could you go ahead and answer that one?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure I caught all the pieces of the question. If you go to attachment two, you'll see that where we are today, and if I understood 6 million, today we had over 5 million domestic international, or last year over 5 million domestic international people go through the terminal. I believe the employments for the target period were 3 million, which would equate to 6 million, and we're only 1 million behind that right now. And I'm not sure if I got the question. Like I said, I did not hear the first part, sir.
Okay, well, I said we have a projection of five times the population of Alaska. If I understand the word employment, that's someone getting on an aircraft to go somewhere. Is that correct?
Basically, that is correct. That is someone getting on an airplane. It could also be counted as someone coming in on Alaska flight from Seattle to Anchorage and then getting on a Ute flight or an Aero flight, the Aero flight, if it were not a co-chair flight. Or not a continuing flight, so they would be counted as an employment also.
Okay. All right, I'll quit beating that, but Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question and not involve this at this time?
Yes.
Mr. Plum, I just a rumor. I don't know any of the details on it, but I understand there's a new underground fuel pipe system that's going to be laid at the airport, rather large. And my question is that going to happen and be in place in conjunction with or before this other construction starts, or are we going to build the new ramps and the new taxiways and so forth and then come dig them back up and put this new fuel line in?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Ryan, I believe the pipeline you're referring to is a pipeline that is being proposed by the fuel consortium that is delivering the fuel to all the carriers right now. It's a separate issue being proposed and developed by that consortium right now, and they're working with the municipality and the state and federal government to get the necessary permits to access fuel, particularly from the Port of Anchorage to the airport. And basically the issue is that because of the growth of traffic at the airport, the capacity of the existing pipeline isn't going to be able to meet the demand that we need, and so we're having to drive trucks in, and so we need at the airport a better way to get the fuel than we currently have. So it's separate, totally separate from the terminal project. And
okay, it won't involve underground fueling.
The pipeline, if the pipeline is the ultimate solution, it'll come into the airport at some point, which will require connecting with either the existing line or another larger diameter line that brings it to the new fuel site on the north side of the terminal there.
I'd just like to comment. We're not going to get through. We just got these questions, and the committee hasn't had really a time. And I'm going to kind of go to general questions with the committee, and then at our next meeting, you might ask Marco. We have some questions that we can we can go over and maybe help us clarify it. We'll have maybe more time before. So with that in mind, Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I've had a chance to, since I arrived here, look over the package and the questions. I thought some of the answers are informative, but I think, as I recall from the questions we had last week, I think some are omitted, as a matter of fact. So if I could repeat myself a little bit and maybe expand on it in the form of questions that don't necessarily have to be answered today. But to the point that was brought up here about the gates, I guess I'm really disturbed about the design of the entire terminal and the fact that we're, for this money, adding only 5 new jetway positions. And then with the, if the projections are such that within in 5-year increments will be a need for 4 each in the 10-year following years. And because of the, what appears to me, a lack of foresight or design in the future footprint. I have talked to Mr. Plum and other people about putting out another concourse between the B concourse and the international concourse. However, I'm concerned about that, and perhaps it is the most only logical place, but it just seems for bang for the buck here, we're getting about $40 million for each jetway. Doesn't seem like a very good investment. Oh, that's not the proper way to look at it, and I understand that. So I am concerned about that and having adequate numbers. But specifically, Mr. Plum, when you're managing those jetways and those gates, you indicate they are proprietary now, so it's really up to the particular airlines. But is there a vacancy factor or turnover rate that helps you manage that? And of course, I think it is, you talked about the common use versus the proprietary use, I think, which has a major impact on that turnover. But as a manager, how do you perceive the numbers of gates you have now and where we're going to be in a few years? I was wondering if you had enough gates, and for spending $200 million, we're only picking up 5 more seems to be a problem that I'm concerned about. If you can't even accommodate your demand currently, and we're only adding 5 more in the time frame of this project, I am concerned about that, particularly when you look at the basic outline of your design where you're adding on to the, almost in a triangular configuration somehow, to the area between where the old Concourse C was, Concourse B, expanding that out, and then I have not satisfied myself of why you're even expanding the 5-foot to the in the east terminal out on the jetway side of the terminal when it's going to disrupt Delta's operations, and unless it has to do with the reconfiguration of the baggage handling below that and the infrastructure needed for the area. And if you're going to pick up 5 feet of space for the people standing in line at the ticket counters by moving 5 feet out on the West Terminal. I just don't understand how that all fits together and why, you know, obviously it's going to be extremely expensive to make that addition. So the whole thing is not fitting together for me. Help me here.
And I'd like to let Don Kettner explain exactly how that's been engineered and what some of the costs are.
This is Don Kettner. I'm a project manager for the terminal redevelopment for Anchorage International. If I could, I'd like to speak to that issue. There's several issues here that I think there may be a little misconception on. First of all, we are proposing about a 40-foot push out the back of gate A1 through about A4 off the back of the ticket lobby and bag claim area. Not 5 feet.
That's 40 feet.
Okay. The reason for doing that is that we will obviously be able to expand the ticketing and bag claim area. I think it's important to understand that one of the main challenges that we face is the imbalance in our terminal today between the air side and the land side. We're very deficient in ticketing and bag claim for the number of gates we have today. The other issue that I wanted to speak to is future expansion. We looked at 14 master plan alternatives for the year 2015, working with Gary Blankenship with Landerman Brown. The airlines participated in evaluating those 14 different concepts, and the concept to provide a future concourse between what is now the International Terminal and Concourse B was viewed to be the most cost-effective plan for the future. And in fact, some of the developments that we're proposing, such as the elevated road system, is currently sized to accommodate the 2015 plan because it would be too costly to do that expansion in multiple phases.
So, Mr. Chairman, to follow up, that's 40 feet. Forgive me for not picking up on that detail. It's a significant difference. However, did you look at actually expanding the baggage pickup area in the new Concourse C area and not really reworking the baggage area in the existing area?
In response to that, we do expand both the bag claim area and the ticketing area in the new C replacement. We did find, though, that it would not be cost-effective to totally replace the ticketing and bag claim that we have today. So expanding what we have today with a combination of new square footage was the least expensive solution to the problem.
Why did you use a 45-degree angle when you go down from the perpendicular line of Concourse B to C and in your 40-foot expansion? It creates a triangular shape, expands a significant amount of square footage and cost. It seems to me, I'm not sure what you pick up from an efficiency standpoint.
It would probably be better to answer that question looking at a conceptual floor plan, and we can make that available to you, but the concept right now is to provide a central retail core to the new terminal space and also to provide for a secure circulation pattern that would allow all gates to be accessed without leaving security. On the lower level, we have an extensive need for operational space and bag makeup, which space lends itself to quite nicely.
Well, I'm glad that's the case, because I wouldn't want to spend $20 million on building a food court there if that was the square footage cost.
We looked at the amount of one of the answers to the questions that you have in your packet addresses the expansion of the concession area, and I think quite simply put, the